American Psycho is how the French newspaper Libération greeted its readers the morning after Donald Trump's shock election win in the United States. While some point to his victory as proof of how little media matters in today's politics, others say newspapers, well, they're more important now than ever. We'll assess the highs and lows of the political pages today on The Stack. On today's programme, can good journalism pull us through the age of President Trump?
I think there is an opportunity to potentially build on the narrative that was there that this is not the right level of leadership, but maybe there is room to rise above and tell these other stories.
Monocle's editor-in-chief Tyler Brulé and our editor Andrew Tuck will join me as we look back at how newspapers shaped the US election and why they have such a vital role to play going forward. That's today on The Stack, Monocle 24's dedicated print industry review and analysis show. Hello and welcome to The Stack with me, Tom Edwards. God forgive America, read Spain's El Periodico. Dear America, no you can't, exclaimed the New Zealand Herald. And in Germany, readers of Die Welt were greeted with an upside-down masthead and headline informing readers that everything had fallen the wrong way. But the morning after this week's stunning election result is but a small part of the long and complex story of the role of newspapers in this campaign. Joining me to discuss that and more is Monocle's editor-in-chief Tyler Brulé and our editor Andrew Tuck. Tyler Brulé, perhaps we'll start with you. It is interesting. A lot of people have said, oh, well, you know, we need to look back at the media's role in Trump's election or their failure to stop this from happening. Is that the wrong question to ask? Or do you think that there are questions, legitimate questions, particularly if we look at the printed presses, about where the media went right or wrong over the last, well, months? It's almost a year and a half, I guess, for the whole campaign.
Yeah, this was a discussion over the last few days, certainly being in both Berlin and Hamburg. And also, you know, on the eve of everything, when I was with Andrew at the start of the week, Andrew, we were in Zurich. And, you know, there, I think we were also just looking at the tone and certainly sort of living it live in maybe more of an electronic fashion. Of course, and, you know, you were the first to text at about sort of 3 or 4 in the morning saying, remarkable result, and on one side, perhaps an opportunity to tell an interesting story. And it'd be, I'm sort of quite intrigued to see really the role that certain media outlets, certain media brands are going to take now. I think everyone knows what our position is. But I think there is a lot of soul searching. And, you know, and this goes, you know, were the people sitting on the politics desk, the national desks, at U.S. papers, you know, really doing their job? I think were people interrogating these polling companies? And I, you know, and again, you know, what have we heard later? Well, yeah, well, all of these companies, of course, they're there to serve a client base, and oftentimes, as we all know, sometimes you tell your clients what they want to hear. So I think that you know, that will occur. But I think one of the big problems that we've seen, you know, throughout all of this, and I'm not sure, gentlemen, where you are on a Saturday, a couple of days after the dust has settled, I'm just so fed up with listening to it, because this is also just the problem of the U.S. electoral system. I'm all for, like in this country, like in Canada, 1 month of campaigning and then we're done. And I think, you know, having this 2-year lead up, you're also just quite exhausted. So I'm happy that it's over. But I think there's a lot of things that need to be unpicked, I think, both in print and certainly in electronic media as well.
I think I've got lots of thoughts for you. Do you want to lead me anywhere or should I just dive in?
Well, no. I felt it seemed like you were going to address
I thought you were going to jump in.
No, I am. The notion of electronic media, and I did kind of mention this to Tom in passing.
Are you fatigued though, Andrew?
Oh, completely fatigued. I think it's... You know,
not just because you've had a hard week.
No, I think everybody, you can see it in the candidates' faces, in the people who've been campaigning, anybody who's been connected with it, and even just people watching via the spectrum of media, that they feel that this is enough, that we we need to move on and we need to sort something out for our lives and for the media as well. But on that electronic media element, I think what's fascinating is that most of these newspapers are now set up in a way that they're feeding stories to people electronically. Mm. So people, you know, as we know, don't these days flick to the business pages. Perhaps, you know, somebody who's been watching the campaign on the front page isn't getting the paper edition anymore. So they're not actually reading the business pages. They don't notice the power plant closing down, the coal mine closing down, the rust belt becoming ever rustier. So there was a sense that people watching stories or reading stories because they're popping into their Facebook feed or into their, you know, their social media. And there, the only stories that people were reading were from maybe from the New York Times, but the only things being shared were things which were affirmative. So people would share a story about why Hillary is amazing or why the Democrats will win in the end. And the world of troubling stories which were on the right didn't pop into their feed. So there became this numbness to what was really going on over the past 2 years because people were fed a constant diet every day through their social media telling them, don't worry, it's going to be okay. This is the direction we're heading. And then when the results came in, it turned out that all of the kind of the Trump reporting wasn't popping into their feed. They just didn't really know the other side of the story.
I'm just wondering if one part of it is the collapse or certainly the significant erosion of a strong local press as well. So once upon a time, if you had a very strong regional paper in Southwest Ohio, you know, in that area of Kentucky, in that part of Michigan, that would have bubbled up to a national level. Then it's very easy for a newsroom to pick up that story. It would have been syndicated. And that simply doesn't happen. On one side, because it's actually gone the other way, that so many local papers that are still around are really sort of, you know, feeding down from the top and are also, and I would say also feeding from the bottom, you know, just delivering a lot of drivel to their pages. And there's not the money to go out and document the lives that have been affected by the closure of that plant, the takeover of that plant and the subsequent job cut. So I'm wondering if that also has played into this as well.
100%. I think also the nature of ownership of those papers that do exist. So what's happened is that many of them have fallen into the hands of a bunch of venture capitalists who are running them for the assets, and we're not quite sure what their real intention is at the end of the day. They're not owned by families who had four or five newspapers.
Who are invested in those communities.
Yeah, exactly. That they wanted to tell the stories. So now you see this kind of, you know, Pulitzer style journalism where some of the big, you know, headline anchor papers will send somebody every now and then off into a community to tell the story of poverty or race, whatever. But the day to day reporting of it is absent in those newspapers too.
Tyler, Trump did vilify the press, the media. There was a barrage. He turned his guns in every direction. If we look then at the next 4 years, people are going to say, look, Trump's made his attitude towards press and journalists very clear. He's quite contemptuous of them. What can newspapers do? Some of the problems we've already identified, they're quite deep-rooted. They're quite deep-seated. There may be an appetite to change them, even in some of those fusty boardrooms that we've been talking about. But what can people do that can make a difference that will make them more effective, you know, in the next term? We're talking about starting from January of next year.
Absolutely. I think there is an opportunity for one or two newspapers, you know, to potentially build on the narrative that was there, that this is not the right level of leadership. But of course, you have to report on the upcoming presidency, and you'll have to be in it, and you'll have to be in the White House press room. But maybe there is room to, I would hope, to rise above all of what will, of course, be sort of, you know, an ongoing sort of back and forth, and tell these other stories that got us to the place where we are today, or at least got the U.S. I think that's the other thing we have to remember as well. It is a global problem. It's much more of a problem probably for Americans than anyone else. And it was interesting. I was at a conference in Berlin earlier in the week called Falling Walls. Very, on one side, very science-focused, but also with a component of humanities. And one of the most interesting speeches that I heard was a gentleman from Sydney, professor, who was talking about the dawn of robotics when it comes to farming and what this is going to mean for agriculture. And you know, I guess on one side, this gentleman painted, you know, a really amazing story about, you know, how efficient things are going to be. And of course, you know, you distill efficiency, meaning job losses, and really a wholesale change for the world of agriculture. But what I thought was really interesting, and I think this throws down a gauntlet to U.S. media, I mean, just looking at the power, of course, of agriculture in the United States, he, at the very end, it was just this, like, very interesting sort of sting in the tail. He just said, you know, now, ladies and gentlemen, I think you all have to ask yourself, you know, how will you feel about consuming something that, you know, human hands have never touched? It really sort of, you know, made you sort of sit back and think, you know, on one side, we're just talking about this whole growers movement and so many people moving, you know, off the tractor, going back to the land. And I think that this is going to be, agriculture is going to be a huge issue. And I would like to see that type of reporting as it's bubbling up right now, having that discussion about what this is going to mean for U.S. industry, not just that we're transferring jobs. You know, oh, well, you used to work on the Ford assembly line and now, oh, well, it's great. Dunkin' Donuts has expanded. So now you're working in a drive-thru window. And that's when we look at how many sort of, you know, positions have been offset. They've been offset by those types of tasks, which, OK, they, you know, they might bring in better than minimum wage and it is a job. But I don't think it's not the same level of pride. I think if you're working on an assembly line at Ford and you've produced something at the end of the day.
Andrew, clearly, you know, Tyler's right. There's going to remain an appetite for that kind of storytelling. You know, that's the sort of agenda we push here. Can that happen on a scale that's big enough to win over maybe some of these media figures, whether it's specific newspapers, the editors of those, the boards who run them, to review their practices and maybe try and hold Trump to account and try and shift the whole narrative in a more constructive direction?
In the end, I feel reasonably hopeful. Most of these newspapers are packed with quality writers, great editors. They tend to be, in the way that America is, diverse. They have people from every community and they will be wanting to tell their stories. And we have to remember that while we're kind of taking some sharp words here, directing them towards what's happened in the media world, in the print media world, you have to nudge that up against, if a comparison against what happened in TV, a Fox TV, an MSNBC, and think, actually, in comparison, these print reporters have done very well. They've done journalism for a start, and I think they will be good. But you know, here's the other thing: is, you know, that a lot of American media is so concerned with being a little bit dry and neutral, and you know, making sure that everything has this huge integrity behind it, that sometimes the passion gets a little bit lost. And I think that over the next 4 years, it will be interesting to see how many newspapers continue to step up to the plate and say, "Okay, do you know what? We have to campaign on behalf of our communities, our cities. You know, for all the people who are not having their stories well told and who need to have a voice." And I actually think that they will find some grit and fire over the coming years to do that.
Tyler, it is interesting if we kind of jump back to Europe, and there's markets that we look to as, you know, examples to follow. Maybe the German print market, they shift a lot of newspapers. There's some great titles. We know there's great journalism, there's great editors there. But Germany's going to maybe be facing up to some similar political questions. What about in France? Likewise, you know, Marine Le Pen, we have these movements across Europe. Do you think that the fact that the media there is maybe a little more robust or maybe a little more serious in some of its coverage means that the country broadly will be better equipped? If we look at, say, Germany as an example, is Germany better equipped to tackle, you know, the alternative for Deutschland because it has a media that maybe is a bit more grown up and a bit more serious possibly than on the other side of the pond?
I was on an ICE train on, was it Thursday evening, went from Berlin to Hamburg, and I was just surprised how many people, and okay, it was a train that left at about 4:30, 5 o'clock, but just the sheer number of people who were reading not one, but two newspapers. And that was just, it wasn't startling, it was refreshing, it was even wonderful that as I stood up, Andrew, you would have liked this, I was like getting my bags, I was getting off the train, and I just saw this gentleman in front of me, and he had a Monocle subscriber's bag. And so I pointed at the bag and sort of gave him the thumbs up. And he's like, he took off his headphones. And he said, you're Tyler. And I was like, because I just want you to know I've been, you know, subscribing for the last 7 years and it's great. Anyway, nice side story. It made me happy in this wagon full of people reading newspapers. But what was interesting is that in Germany, you have people who are reading, and this goes back to, I think, the point of local newspapers or regional papers. So people are reading the Süddeutsche. It was Thursday, so Die Zeit had just come out, and people are reading, you know, Berliner Morgenpost or whatever. But then there was also people, you know, reading the Hamburger Morgenpost, and they were reading their local papers as well. And that was even striking. I thought about it on the flight back to London, Hamburg Airport. We just don't see that. I mean, we don't even have that, the scale and volume, maybe even the logistics to support it, where you can be at Hamburg Airport and you can find the, I don't know, the Augsburger Allgemeine, and you can have a newspaper from Stuttgart, and you can have the Tegernsee Abendblatt, or, you know, I mean, I'm not sure if that exists or not. I don't think it does. But anyway,
let's launch it.
Well, we'd all like to write a paper on Tegernsee. But that was what's amazing. So even in this country, and you certainly wouldn't see in the United States. I mean, in the United States, you would see the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, and that's, I mean, the USA Today would be there as well. So I like that this dialogue and this level of awareness, you know, what is happening within your own constituency, within your own municipality in Germany, might be, I'm quite convinced, it is better covered than we're able to offer. I think even more so than France. I don't think France, you know, does not have that same level of regional papers that you see in Germany. I want to go back to one story which was lost in the press because it happened the morning. And this is a story which, sadly comes from South London, which was this tram accident earlier in the week. 7 people killed, scores injured. Now, the story was largely buried by, of course, the Trump win. And I go back to also just this local media and I think, the state of journalism in this country. What's going to happen to that story? Are we just going to wait for the official report? And I feel that we've also moved into this world. Even I think if I listen to, and Andrew, we talk about this all the time. If you listen to a lot of the BBC outlets, the first 4 or 5 stories every morning are driven by press releases. They're driven by the spin that comes from any number of different agencies. The NHS says this, or someone, or a critical agency of the National Health Service, says X. And then you have an obesity finding, and then you have something else, which is maybe a more cuddly story, but certainly of political nature, and probably released by Whitehall. And I wonder, here we've had quite a tragic accident, something which is quite severe. Who's going to investigate that story? Is the Standard going to do it in London? Absolutely not. Is it going to be the role of local radio, BBC? I don't think so. And so we just wait for the official findings, which we would hope have been thorough. But that's where I also sort of wonder, the role in all of this. And it sort of comes back to just the amount of time which is just being spent, certainly within Westminster, but also on the part of media just covering this Brexit story.
What about a final note then?
I've got a good final note. This is the story of the week. I don't think you even saw this story yet.
I'm looking forward to finding it out.
Anyway, I was talking about being on the train with people reading Die Zeit the other day, and they've got a great supplement. And of course, the lovely editor, Christoph Amend, gets more name checks than any other editor on this program. Anyway, so they have an interesting cover story on the anniversary of the Paris attacks. And I thought that was going to dominate the entire issue. But no, we have the story here is Der Springende Punkt, and it's about cats. And it says, what do cats, do when they're alone? Are they sleeping or are they flying? And this is just,
let's have a look at this.
It's classic Die Zeit story. You would never see this in
it's a flying cat story.
It is a flying cat story. It looks like a rather Dutch or maybe Flemish last name. And these cats are sort of flying across. And it's just, to me, that is German supplement journalism at its best.
Katzen im Anflug.
Exactly.
Yeah, it says it all.
It's got humour. It's got humour.
It's got exceptional photography.
Andrew, you must have some flying cat puns ready to go, no?
I probably have, but I think they'd be X-rated, so I won't say them.
There you go. So check out this week's Zeit magazine if you just need to get some proper inspiration.
Yeah, but I think that's what a good magazine does. You can treat and you can deal with something as important and put the anniversary of the Paris attacks on it. And with some safe distance, with a good sort of 10, 15, 16 pages between, you're going to have cats in flight.
Cats in Manflug.
Cats in Manflug.
on that note, we'll leave it there. Tyler Boulay, Andrew Tuck, thank you both very much indeed for being with us on The Stack this week. The relentless race for the White House has left many of us feeling rather uncertain about many of our shared values, and not least about the role of the media. Donald Trump's courting of the press certainly proved lucrative for some. TV news ratings are up. People are buying more newspapers. Online news clicks, well, they're skyrocketing too. At last, journalism is saved. Well, sadly, perhaps not quite. The biggest challenge that newspapers could face in the years ahead may be the threat that the president-elect poses to them. But as Monocle's Ben Ryland explains, the best newspapers should prove to be up to the challenge.
As the shock of this week's US election sinks in and commentators all over the world scream over who or what's to blame, there's perhaps just one clear winner in all of this mess: the media.
We are in a rigged system, and a big part of the rigging are these dishonest people in the media.
America's new president-elect has an interesting relationship with the media. Despite his career being largely built upon a foundation of courting attention for his every wacky theory, he was once again back to his old ways this week as he lashed journalists for having apparently incited fierce protests erupting across the United States against his election. Megan Garber is a writer for The Atlantic. In the lead-up to this year's election, Monocle's culture program asked her whether the role of satire in the media could have been more effective in its skewering of Trump's rhetoric.
It's hard to know in retrospect, right? Because at the beginning, I think a lot of people, including just reporters in the media, didn't fully appreciate what he was going to do. You know, I think there was the attitude at first that he was a little bit of a sideshow and a little bit there for the entertainment value, that he wasn't serious about it. Perhaps his voters even weren't that serious about it. And once it became clear that he actually was a very serious contender for the presidency, people started to take him a lot more seriously. But already the groundwork had been laid that, you know, he's mostly just there for show and for entertainment.
To be fair, it is difficult for many of us in the media to grasp how a thrice-married accused sexual predator who labels Mexicans as rapists could ever find his way to the White House, let alone take a seat in the Oval Office. And yet, here we are. So what was the major miscalculation? How did America's media misread its public this badly? There's no doubt that Trump-related news attracts a lot of clicks. This election campaign has seen some newspapers reaching the level of online readers that many would have thought impossible before now. But Margaret Sullivan at The Washington Post takes a somewhat darker view of Trump's effect on the media.
I don't think that he specifically threatens journalists' safety, but he's definitely threatening press rights. He's talked many times about wanting to go up against or to change the libel laws and to change the laws that allow journalists to do their jobs.
Speaking to MSNBC's Morning Joe, Sullivan was commenting on an unprecedented move by the Committee to Protect Journalists to label Trump a threat to press freedom during his election campaign. Days after the election result, The New Republic's Brian Buettler decimated much of the media's coverage of Trump, writing that the same press that was preparing itself 2 days earlier to cover Hillary Clinton's emails for two more years swept Trump's penchant for sexual assault and other depredations out of memory overnight. The cordiality of this so far smooth transition, he wrote, is entirely delusional, and so is the media reporting it. But the sad story of Trump versus the media isn't just a tale of flirtations with the fanciful and Clinton clickbait. It's about the continued survival of the news cycle as we know it. Writing for the New York Times, Jim Rutenberg pointed to a peak in the election news frenzy almost coinciding with the most dire economic outlook for newspapers that we've yet seen. His paper, along with The Wall Street Journal and The Guardian, have all recently announced plans to reorganize, retrench staff, or cut entire sections. Some weeks ago, Monocle's editor-in-chief Tyler Brulé told The Stack that an increased focus on a paper's digital operation at the expense of its print audience is surely bad news.
There's rumors that the Observer is on the block, which is owned by The Guardian because they need to offload that. Hard to say how much cash they'll get for it. But, you know, we saw Alan Rusbridger many years ago, you know, really, I would say, painting himself into a corner, saying digital future, this is where it's going to be. But yet we look at the recent numbers, it's a catastrophe for them. But then the other great celebrated newspaper brand in this market, sort of the digital hero, of course, is the Mail Online.
Yes, the Daily Mail, that enviable publication we can credit for solving the mystery weather patterns of the Bermuda Triangle and spreading the valuable work of other journalists by copying their craft word for word and claiming it as their own. Believe it or not, the Mail Online attracts a lot of readers.
It is the most powerful English language news brand in the world online, and yet the analysts are also worried that they can't make it work digitally.
If anything has become clear as the world of online media matures, it's that the way forward is some form of happy medium where print and online coexist. Yet somehow the big question still lingers. How?
Well, the first thing is that you have to become digitally sustainable before you become print unsustainable.
Juan Senor is from Innovation Media Consulting. He told The Stack that the focus on making audiences bigger and bigger has obscured the foundation of a healthy business model.
And what's happening at the Mail on Sunday and what's happening with a lot of these digital plays when it comes to newspapers is they've been chasing massive audiences. We've gone from journalism to voyeurism.
Among the many lessons to come from this election campaign, that is surely one of the most pertinent. As the Trump phenomenon grew bigger, many news outlets saw their audiences growing with it. And so, naturally, the Trump news articles kept coming. Clearly, journalism wasn't the priority here. But shouldn't that at least mean that the profit books are looking a bit healthier?
There was a promised land that if you created an audience, if you built it, they would come, that the business would be there. And it's failed. It's not there. There is no business there to be had just by creating a massive audience and selling display advertising against it. Why? Because there's so much volume, there's so much inventory out there that the CPMs, the cost per thousand, what advertisers pay for that audience has diminished massively.
As part of his report for the New York Times, Jim Rutenberg quoted the Democratic Senator Claire McCaskill saying that the failing business model of real journalism is the biggest threat facing the American democracy. But she also said that journalism is partly to blame for being slow to adjust as the internet took hold and social media opened the competitive floodgates. Speaking among the many publishers in attendance at the Frankfurt Book Fair recently, Monocle's editor Andrew Tuck was clearly not quite ready to adopt the gloomy tone hanging over many other publishers.
Publishers here are launching new magazines. Now, that is not happening still in the UK market. Still, the big publishers are slow, cautious. But here, there's a return to confidence. It's that, yes, we need to bring out new titles. Yes, we need to be engaging people across all of the ways we put out our stories, but definitely, definitely in print.
The rise of Donald Trump to the White House is at least partly a result of the media treating a divisive demagogue politician as a mere celebrity curiosity. But if a flailing media helped put him there, surely a dose of strong journalism can help set things straight. The Washington Post's Margaret Sullivan says that is a chapter yet to be written.
He's really riled people up and made people mistrust the media in a way that is really troubling to me because, again, I know how important our work is. And, you know, now there's this sort of feeling that we're evil, we're part of this rigged conspiracy. And it's going to be very hard to go up against that. I think that we need to start sort of telling our story a little bit better.
Thank you, Ben. And that's all for this week's programme. My thanks to our guests, Tyler Brulé and Andrew Tuck, and to the Stack's producers, Ben Rylan and Fernando Augusto Pacheco. The programme was edited, as ever, by Claire Urban. Comments or queries are welcome. Drop us a note. Fernando's on fp@monocle.com. And don't forget to join us at the same time next Saturday. You can always listen again, if you're going to miss us, at monocle.com or via iTunes. I'm Tom Edwards. Until next time, it's goodbye.